Can you hear me? Okay, welcome everybody. Thank you for coming. See, we were here yesterday. Holy moly. That usually doesn't happen. People come back. I don't really know what to do right now because I'm sorry. I just need to sit down for a second. Guys, thank you for sitting in the back row. That doesn't make me feel bad at all. Just want to escape, and you people sleeping over there, that's good. Okay, good. All right, so let's talk about this. A few years ago, and maybe you can relate to this, a few years ago on my website, by prompting from some friends of mine, I asked a question of people who read my blog. Give me one or two things that make it difficult for you to stay Christian. So this is for insiders. It's not for people on the outside looking in. It's people insiders. You're Christian. You're working at it. And give me one or two things. And I wound up getting hundreds of responses, which I was pretty surprised about. And what I did was, in a very unscientific way, I sort of collated them into five categories. And I want to sort of share with you, whether you've read, The Sin of Certainty or not, just to sort of share with you what those five things were and what we can sort of do about them. And by that, I don't mean solve them, right? Here's the answer to that difficult problem. I don't do that. I think some of these problems are actually windows to take us someplace else where we may need to be, right? So let's look at those. The first one is God is violent. And that is probably the most prominent issue that came up from people who responded to me. And it's true. I mean, it seems to be that, you know, some act of violence is like God's go-to method of resolving conflicts. I have friends of mine in the Episcopal world, and you know Episcopalians, they don't read the Bible. Right? So this one Episcopal parish near me, they wonderful people, they read it actually every Sunday a lot, right, with the liturgy. But the liturgy tends to skip things like everybody dies, right? So these Episcopalians are reading through the Bible in 90 days. Which is amazing. I think about that. That's like 15 chapters a day or something like that. Day two, I'm getting email messages saying, people are dropping like flies. Can you come explain this to us, right? Which is true. I mean, you get to chapter 6 of the Bible, and God has already had it. I don't know what to do. Everybody dies. Everybody drowns. Right? Now, that's a topic for another day, but the fact is that that's there. That is an issue that people deal with. And you know, some of the big issues of violence in the Old Testament is the whole taking of the land of Canaan, kill everything that breathes, including animals. And again, we could talk about that, but my problem here, my issue here is not to solve these things, but just to sort of lay out what are the kinds of things that get people all riled up reading the Bible, especially after 9/11. Right? A common Christian response to 9/11 was, see, that Islam religion, see what their God approves of, and what other people said, especially atheists, responded saying, do you ever read the Bible? You ever read Genesis? You ever read Joshua and Judges and Deuteronomy? Ever read those books? There's a tremendous amount of violence. And it's sort of hard to know what to do with it. The blessings, the blessings and the curses, this came up yesterday in the book of Deuteronomy, right? A young professor I know once years ago, I think in an effort to impress me, said that he and his young family of maybe three kids, ages like 3 to 8 or something like that, he said, our family devotions were reading through the book of Deuteronomy. And I'm like, well, let me know how that goes. Like when you get to chapter 20 and everybody dies. And the curses in chapter 28... When I teach a Pentateuch course at Eastern, and we read through the curses in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, and if you're not familiar with it, you should read them sometime. It's horrible. It's like, you know, you're going to eat your own children if you disobey the covenant. I'm going to make it so bad for you. Disease, pestilence, plague, your wives and daughters will be taken away from you right before your eyes. And at one point it says, and everything else I haven't mentioned is also going to happen to you. Right, it's like a father who over the top punishment. You know, you don't make your bed and you're grounded for 3 years or something like that. It's just, it's a hard thing to process. And again, Historically, there are reasons why Deuteronomy looks the way that it does. Historically, there are reasons why the Canaanite stories look the way that they do. Historically, there are reasons why the flood story looks the way that it does. But that's immaterial. I just ask people, what are some things that make it hard for you to stay Christian? And the first thing on the list is people. You know, God is violent himself towards others, either the nations around them. One thing that threw my daughter, when she was 10, threw her for a loop, was the fact that all the Egyptian army drowned in the Red Sea. And she asked me, said, aren't they God's children too? I'm like, good for you. Good for you asking a question like that, you know. Or God commands Israel to inflict punishment on others, right? Or God, like in those curses in Deuteronomy, inflicts punishment on Israelites for disobedience, right? I mean, the quick answer to that is we're dealing with a tribal culture, and that's just how you do things back then. And within the Old Testament itself, you have debates and dialogues about that sort of thing. In the New Testament, certainly you have sort of movement on that whole area, but it's still there. It's in the Bible, and what do you do with it? Okay, that's the first one. Second one is science, right? Right, the Bible and science collide on too many things to think that the Bible has anything to say to us today about the big questions of life. And I think there's an element of truth to that, right? And it's you know, the big one people talk about is evolution. You know, that's back in the news in part because an evangelical Christian, Francis Collins, was head of the international team that mapped the human genome, which basically said, yeah, it's true. It's hard to avoid the argument for common descent, right? So, I mean, that's one thing, but, you know, there are other things that I think are even without evolution, things that I think are just difficult to process about a scientific way of looking at things that we take for granted all the time, right? We know that human-like things have been around for a long time, right? And they have their own cultures. And when you look at the long expanse of humanity and then you take the biblical story, it's this tiny, 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 tiny little sliver, right, which goes back about 6,000 years, which is not nearly the beginning. And, like, what do I do with this? What do I do with this story in this larger scientific context? A big thing, right, and I know some of you can relate to this, a big issue that comes up in terms of the scientific thing is psychology. Or psychiatry and how the mind works and our brain chemicals and all that, which I don't understand. You know, I mean, that's not my area. But I know people who have been helped more in their lives from Lexapro and good therapy than from any sermon they ever heard. So you look at that and you say, okay, I thought the Bible had all the answers to everything that ails us. And there are, I mean, again, I'm not trying to impose a view on you. I'm just telling you what I think. Right? I know Christians who say that the only therapy you need is a good sermon. And I'm not sure that's really helpful to people who are clinically depressed or have phobias or name it, right? I'm not sure if that really helps. They're helped more by people who aren't even Christians, who happen to know a field, who have wisdom in a field, right, that helps them tremendously. And so, you know, there's maybe less of a tendency in some circles, including Christian circles, to talk about our innate sin that needs to be forgiven and maybe our innate dysfunction as a result of our family of origins that have screwed us up, and we've all been screwed up by our family of origins, and how we try to cope with that and sort of grow out of that into healing. So the metaphor is more one of healing a dysfunction than it is to forgive you because you're bad. That makes more sense to people. That's a model that they can live with. That makes sense of the world they live in and not always the biblical idea of you're righteous or you're unrighteous, which one are you going to be? Right. Yay, Bible. Okay. Third one is God's absence, which, again, I know a lot of you can relate to. In the face of injustice and heinous suffering in the world, God seems disinterested or perhaps unable to do anything about it. This is sort of like the age-old problem of evil. If God is good and if God is almighty, why do bad things happen? That's pre-biblical. Right? The ancient Babylonians had a story that the scholars call the Babylonian theodicy. Theodicy means defending God or justifying God. How can you defend the divine in light of the fact that bad things happen to good people? That's the book of Job, right? That's very similar to that. Why is a bad thing happening to somebody who just frankly doesn't deserve it? Right? So you have all these things that happen to people. And one thing I mentioned in the book, because this was really, this is one of these moments where it sort of shook me a little bit. I think I was either in seminary or just starting teaching seminary. This is sometime like in the 80s or 90s, and there was a story of a woman who was jogging in Fairmount Park in Philadelphia, which is a nice park. And back in the days when you had a Walkman and big headsets running around, right? So, and she's running, and a branch fell off, broke off a tree, landed on her head, and killed her just like that. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, where's God when you need him? It's as if this is perfectly timed. I don't think it was, but leave home 30 seconds earlier. Don't get into a traffic jam, or get into a traffic, anything to avoid that, right? And I remember putting myself in the position of the family, like, what do you say to them? You know, if they're religious at all, what does a pastor, rabbi, or somebody, what do you say to somebody like that, right? There's Psalm 121, which says, the Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon at night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time on and forevermore. I would not read that to the family, right? But sometimes the Bible just presents things like this. It's saying like, well, I'm going to claim this promise for myself, but yet bad things keep happening to good people, and it's hard to know what to do with. I mean, people sent me things that have happened to them or family members that they probably have never told anybody else. There's something about the anonymity of the internet, you know, where you can sort of do things like that. But just, I don't know how some of these people keep going day after day. And there are people here, I'm sure, who have stories like that as well. I don't. I haven't had those kinds of stories, but I know people who have. And so I think of, you know, people I also know who pray that the traffic won't be too bad, so they can get to the mall and take advantage of that sale before it's over, and they get a good parking space. And I'm like, how about holding that prayer for a second? Pray about ISIS first. Let's do that. And then drinking water for people, and then other things. And then we'll get to your parking space, right? So, but, you know, where is God? What is God doing? How do we explain that, right? And that is probably the oldest thing of the five, you know, that people brought up. And it doesn't go away, folks. It doesn't go away. Alas. Alrighty. The fourth is whether Christianity is the only way. In our ever-shrinking world, it's very difficult to hold on to the notion that Christianity is the only path to God. Again, this is a common thing that people brought up. And I think of Rachel Held Evans, which is a name that I'm sure a lot of you know. She wrote a book years ago, which is now called Faith Unraveled, if you're familiar with that book. But years ago, it was called Evolving in Monkey Town. Did it ring a bell to anybody? Because she grew up in Dayton, Tennessee, the scene of the Scope Monkey Trials. And so she grew up out of fundamentalism, so Evolving in Monkey Town is sort of a funny title. Anyway, but she tells a story of going to, and again, the details escape me exactly. It was either India or Pakistan, visiting her sister who's doing some sort of mission work there. And she's like struggling with her faith anyway, Rachel is. And she goes there, and she just sees poverty that she has never seen before. And she saw a woman who was about 20, she said, who had a child, an infant, her own, evidently. and the infant's starving and she's starving. And the only thought in that mother's mind was finding a way to feed her baby. And Rachel basically came to the conclusion, I don't think she's going to hell because of where she was born and because of who she is. Right? See, in the world that's become so small, it's much more difficult. We still manage to find a way, but it's much more difficult to have insiders and outsiders. The other is somebody who's living next to you. The other is somebody you go to school with. I mentioned yesterday one of the more challenging moments for me in graduate school was meeting people who had no clue what I was thinking about. They had no understanding of what I took to be self-evident, which is a Christian faith. And yet they were some of the nicest people I've ever known in my life, and they babysit my kids and all that sort of stuff, right? So in our ever-shrinking world, it can be very difficult to maintain those distinctions. And you start asking yourself, at least I do, you know, what about other faiths? What about them? What about my Jewish professors at Harvard who are just amazing people and who taught me so much, right? And I look at them and they say, they're who they are because of when, where, and under what circumstances they were born. Same with me. What right do I have to say anything to these people? What can I add, right? It's easier to think in terms of your own omniscience when you're isolated, but when the world is all around you all the time, you can't do that. And that's what people find to be a challenge. Why this faith and not some other? Why? Right. Anyway, I'm not telling you what you should be dealing with. You can deal with whatever you want. I'll ask you later. Maybe you have other things. But these are the top five things in this blog survey thing that I did a few years ago. Okay, and the last one is sort of surprised me. Mean Christians. Christians treat each other with such malice that it calls into question the validity of the Christian faith and even God's existence. And I have to be honest with you, that struck me at first, like that didn't make sense to me. But over the years, I've come to see, actually, I do think I understand a little bit more why people would put this down. I know many people who've been sorely mistreated by spiritual leaders, whether institutionally or in the church, put down, maligned, slandered, ostracized, pushed out of the community for various reasons that I think probably aren't good ones to push people out. Like, I think differently about issue X, Y, or Z. I always think of the Apostle Paul, like in Romans especially, where he takes on the topic of dietary restrictions, which was a Jewish, important element of Judaism in the first century. Maintaining dietary restrictions marked them off as not being Gentile. It was a very important indicator of being Jewish, as was circumcision and Sabbath observance and some other things. And Paul writes to the church at Rome, which is made up of Jewish believers and Gentile believers, saying that that doesn't matter anymore. Right? A very important, think about this. The Old Testament's pretty clear. There are some things you eat and some things you don't eat. It's given by God to Moses on Mount Sinai in Leviticus chapter 11. Read that scintillating chapter about rock badgers and all sorts of kinds of animals. I don't even know what they are. And all sorts of reasons for why you don't eat this thing or you do eat that thing. And as odd as it seems to us, in the first century, it was a way of maintaining fidelity to the law of God given to Moses on Mount Sinai. And Paul says that distinction doesn't matter anymore. And in fact, what's more important is that you love each other and get along. To build a fellowship, to prove, and to not bring dishonor to God. You prove to the world, by the love you have for each other, that this Jesus thing actually works. Right? But 1 John chapter 4, I don't know what verse, it's a short chapter, look it up, you'll find it. Paraphrasing somewhat, no one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God is in your midst. The closest you get to seeing God is by how you treat each other. So I started thinking about this more, and I get it, right? And it also reminds me of how community-oriented the faith is. It's not an individualistic faith. It's community-oriented. So that when the community gangs up against you, you just say, well, I can just join the Rotary Club, and it's going to be better off for me, and plus they do bowling and drink beer. What difference does it make? Why do I have to stay here and take this abuse from somebody, right? And I'm not exaggerating, because I know people who have left the Christian faith because of how they were treated. I don't think they should do that, but that's not my point here. That's their reality. That's what they're dealing with. So I think this is the tricky one, because of the five issues that are given, this is the only one we have control over. We don't control science. Right, we don't control the way the Bible portrays God with a lot of violence. We don't control whether you feel the absence of God. We don't control that the world is shrinking and we're engaged with people of different faiths or no faiths. Right, but this is the one thing that we actually can control and do something about. And that's why I can see it. This is like the worst one almost. Right. So no more fighting over the colors of carpets in church, or And really to step on toes, whether you have instruments or not in the church service. But I get to fly home in a plane tomorrow and not deal with you people, so I'm fine with that. Okay. I want to pause here for a second. I have a whole other thing to do. I want to talk about how acknowledging these things can actually move us to another place, perhaps. But just before we do that, do any of you have anything to add to these five? Any other things that make it difficult either for you to stay Christian or you know somebody? Yeah. And whether you're praying to anything or anyone. Yeah. Whether it makes any difference at all.
Well, you mentioned 1 John. You talked about also if I pray in accordance with the will.
Right.
Things like that. And,
right.
And like a lot of times I think maybe my prayer is helping me to align more with who God is.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can pray more accordance with the will.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I'm not quite there yet.
Right. And I try to be cautious too about absolutizing verses in the Bible, because one of the most helpful things ever said to me by a seminary professor was, when you're reading much of the New Testament, the letters, you're reading somebody else's mail. And there are circumstances to which these things are attributable, that maybe there's something going on in that audience. They need to hear that message, right? But that doesn't mean it's sort of like a formula. This is so non-formulaic, the Christian faith. It's not a formula, but it might be something to shoot for. And to keep persevering in. So yeah, that's good. And anything else? Any other issue? Yeah.
I have a friend who's been struggling for some time now with kind of going along with the person, but slightly different idea. Like, that God is abusive.
Yes. I've heard that too. Yeah.
Says that he loves us and that he does these things to us.
Yeah.
And tell us we still have to love him anyway.
Right. Which is sort of like a definition of manipulation and abuse, right? Yeah. I mean, I would, if time allowed, I would probably frame the issue a little bit differently, and then remembering that the Christian faith has this narrative that continues, and we do have the Jesus thing to address too, right? So, but I get it. See, it's in the Bible, and if you think, as many people do, that all parts of the Bible are equally ultimate, there's no prioritizing of texts, that becomes more of a problem, I think. Right, I don't know enough about you guys, but I know, like, Methodists, for example, they're very big on, and Lutherans are very big on Christ being the center of how we understand the nature of God, and the stuff in the Old Testament, some of it works, some of it doesn't, right, which is an easier way for me to live, I don't know, but, yeah. Anybody, yeah.
Americanism versus Christianity, or the entanglement thereof.
Right. And I've talked to many people too who say, I want nothing to do with Christianity because of how it looks, and it's just I don't want to identify at least with that anymore. So yeah, Yeah.
Faith itself and belief sometimes seems like a capricious thing. Some people have it, some people don't. Sometimes God feels very real. Sometimes it, you know, you wake up one morning and belief seems absurd.
Right.
You know, you have a friend who, you know, grew up going to church and all of a sudden it's just, you know,
right.
You know, that connection or that awareness.
Right.
Just isn't there, and it's hard to pin down exactly, and it just seems sometimes like.
It's exhausting is what it is, too, right? Like, how do I keep this up? Because some days it feels right, some days it doesn't. Right? And you can't tell anybody that, except in an auditorium full of people. Way to go. Good job. So, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, just a quick example, like 2001, 9/11, that was God's wrath on this country.
Right.
Or this last election, if you don't vote for this person, you're working against God. Or if you do, I mean, you need to come in from within the Christian community.
Right, right.
And I tell people, I'm a believer, but I don't believe that. I don't believe that. No, I don't believe that. It was like a checklist of you don't believe.
Right, exactly. Rather than a positive vision for humanity and the earth and all that sort of stuff, right? I don't know either. Yeah. This mingling of the Christian faith and politics, well, it's something that's actually condemned in the New Testament, if you ask me. Read the book of Revelation. It's all about you don't mix the worship of the true God with the Roman Empire. Read Paul. Paul's adamant about Jesus is Lord, Caesar is not, right? And boy, is that easy to forget. And it makes you think, like, this is just another cultural game we're playing here. The Christian faith, it's just another politics is all it is. You know, and it can be discouraging for people. Yeah?
Lack of supernatural experience
right.
as evidence for God.
We need those God moments, and they come, like, once every 500 years to people, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's true. Here's the thing, though. This, when I first realized this years ago, it was sort of baffling. You would all probably agree in the Old Testament, God does a lot of talking. Wrong. Think of the book of Genesis. Talking to Adam, yak, 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 right? Then Noah, talk, 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 talk. Abraham, talk, 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 talk. Isaac, no. Jacob, one time, Joseph, not at all. As you continue in the biblical narrative, God does less talking. Then with Moses, it gets amped up. And then after Moses, prophets. It isn't like God's going around talking to people all the time. People don't have those supernatural experiences in the Old Testament. You think they do, but they actually don't. In some places, yeah. See, I mean, a lot of these things, what you're bringing up is actually sort of a variation on number three, the absence of God. If God is creator of the universe, why don't we, why isn't it? Some of my more scientifically in tune friends would say, if God is real, why isn't there evidence for God? And other friends of mine who are equally in tuned and also philosophically and theologically inclined would say, God is not a thing you test for. God is not a being you look at and see. God is being. God is the ground of being. God is, I mean, it's just, we can't get away from this kind of stuff. You know, it's if God exists, can you really point to God? And, you know, I think about, for me, you know, getting back to like the science issue, the thing that I have struggled with a lot is the size of the universe. I mentioned this yesterday. It's just really big. It's incomprehensibly big. And there are billions of galaxies, billions of stars in the galaxies. And the stars in the galaxies are separated by what for me is an incomprehensible distance, light years. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have atoms and atomic particles and, well, why not subatomic particles? Let's just make it even more difficult, you know, and string theory and all this stuff. And it's like, what do I have to add to this discussion here about the nature of God? If God exists, what can I add to this? Right? Actually, we're getting on to the next thing here. Let's do that, and hopefully we'll have some time for a little more discussion. But these five things, I call them uh-oh moments, which we all have. But I think uh-oh can become aha. But not because here are the answers to the problems, but because I think these problems force us to maybe think differently about the nature of the Christian faith. In good ways, maybe in not always the most comfortable ways, but I think still in good ways. I have a few of these here too, and I hope not to belabor too much. It's after two already. But first, I think the challenges of the modern world make it hard to remain a certain kind of Christian. I don't think the challenges of the modern world, like science, etc., make it hard to be Christian, but it makes it hard to be a certain kind of Christian where you're frankly used to having it all wrapped up neatly and you sort of get the universe. I may have a couple questions about God and how things work, but I basically understand the nature of reality, right? Well, I mean, scientific investigations can throw a wrench into that by showing us how much more complicated things are. And I know scientists who are Christian who say what's beautiful is that the more we discover, the more mystery you also see in the universe. And that's why I think, you know, this modern world is sort of, one theologian calls it an acid bath. It's the acid bath of the modern world where it burns off simplistic notions of what God is like and how God works. And what leaves in its place is sort of like a bare-bones skeleton that you now have to work your life fleshing out again and thinking about what is God like, right? What kind of a God are we dealing with here? So I think it can do this for us. Well, let me put it this way. I don't know who said this, either Mark Twain or Rousseau. It depends on which website I'm looking at. But the internet is wonderful for this sort of thing. But God created man in his image, and we've been returning the favor ever since. Right? I think that's true. I do it. I think we all think of God in ways that is compatible to how we think. What the modern experiment has done, in a sense, is it's burned off some of our thinking about what God is like and left us with maybe how I think God works isn't the way God works. Maybe I've been too captivated and enamored by my own thinking and by my own theology. Maybe God is bigger than all that. I sure hope so. I mean, if theological precision and perfection is requisite for going to heaven, I'm going to be lonely. That's all I can say. I'm not going to have anybody to talk to. My students don't like that joke either, but that's okay. All right, the second thing, God is transrational. Not irrational, and I'm not against reason because we're human beings, and reason is a good thing, but God is transrational. And again, I think of the universe and the size of the universe, and if God exists, we're dealing with something, and even saying something is a metaphor. All our language of God is metaphorical because we don't grasp it, but we use language to talk about it, right? But, you know, if God exists, this God is beyond my understanding. And yet we still believe as Christians that God is actually interested in us on this pale blue dot that we live on. And I find that to be so utterly unsettling in a good way. I just back up and I say, again, I don't have anything to add to this. It's about being a child and entering into this. And that's really what it comes down to, I think. So anyway, so the faith is transrational. It's beyond our ability to understand. But yet we get to use our reasoning faculties to try to make some sense of it. That's where things like theology comes from. And it's all good. Right? I do it all the time. But we just can't be fooled into thinking that what we think is the real thing and there's nothing left to do. Right. Okay. The third is that Christianity is set up for letting go of the illusion of certainty and control. And what I mean is this. The pillars and foundations of the Christian faith, I will put it this way, in my opinion, is incarnation and resurrection, neither of which make the slightest bit of sense. Oh, incarnation, I got that. Oh, do you really? Resurrection, you're dead and then you're not dead anymore? I mean, in the first century, they had problems with that, right? An incarnate, what does it mean for God to be among us, right? So you've got these two things that are the pillars of the Christian faith that really defy reason and that defy explanation. And that's God's little joke on the Western world, I'm convinced. Like, okay, go ahead, start off by being reasonable. I can prove this. No, you can't. It begins by accepting something that is not understandable, right? I find that strangely comforting. I really do, right? All right, fourth, adjusting our expectations about what the Bible can deliver. I think this could have been first, because I think this is actually the key move forward that's hard to make for many people. I wrote another book a few years ago called The Bible Tells Me So. It's the yellow one, for those of you wondering. But there, the point that I make over and over and over again in that book is that the Bible is not sort of an owner's manual. It's not a rule book. It's not a set of instructions. But it's modeling for us our own journey of faith, because it's so diverse and so all over the place, right? And I think if we can adjust our expectations of what the Bible is prepared to do, right? So is the Bible prepared to offer a scientific alternative to the creation of the world? I don't think so. It's not prepared to do that. It's not written to do that. Is it prepared to give us a videotape history of Israel? It's not prepared to do that because you have different voices interpreting Israel's history in contradictory, irreconcilable ways. Again, that's God's little joke on the Western mind. Well, God has to be consistent. No, we don't. It does what he wants to do, right? So I think, the challenges of the modern world can help us adjust our expectations about what we even expect from the Bible. And once those expectations have been adjusted, you can almost just hear the collective, thank you. You know, I don't have to defend this stuff all the time and make it fit into some predetermined box that I think God has to be operating in, right? So, I think that's actually good news. Did I do that? Okay, I have three more left, and you're adults. You don't need to have this thing working here. So I pressed some button. Let me try one more. Did I press this one? No. Okay. The fifth one. I have three more. Fifth one is trust your God moments. And what I mean by that is, a question that I get a lot from people is like, okay, they hear me talk about the Bible in ways that are very different than what they're used to, and they say this makes complete sense. I get it. I really like this. However, 10 years ago, I had this amazing spiritual experience based on an interpretation of a verse that I now know was wrong. So did that really happen? I say, oh, absolutely. Because God meets us where we are. That's sort of the deal. and there's things that I think now that I'm probably wrong about, and I'll see it differently in 5 years or 10 years, right? But it's, trust your God moments rather than trying to defend them and put them in this intellectual structure where it all sort of makes sense and fits into place. Right? God works outside of those structures, and we can trust the God moments that we've had as being genuine and authentic. Now, sometimes we can't stay there. We have to continue growing and moving. That's important, too. But that doesn't mean God didn't meet us where we were. Right? The sixth is that God is not a crutch. And this is the issue of suffering in the Christian life. And for me, one of these aha moments is seeing, and I don't say this lightly, the way in which suffering does not mean God's absence, but might actually mean something that is, I'm not going to say good, I'm really struggling for a word here, something that is of some benefit. I used to look down on people who would say things like, if it weren't for God, I don't know how I would get through this. And if I weren't leaning on Jesus, I don't know how I would get through this. I feel like, get over it. Just go to a doctor or something. Is that the only reason you believe? Because things aren't going well? But, in the years, I've come to sort of repent of that notion, because I think people who are suffering may actually be more in touch with God than I am. Exactly because of the suffering. Have you ever wondered why there's so much suffering in the Bible? I mean, it's like old Israel is like constantly in some state of things are not going well, almost as if it's Israel's calling to suffer, right? And the whole gospel thing involves a great suffering. And Paul says, you know, if you want to be like Jesus, you suffer with him. You know, I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of participating in his sufferings. Right? That's part of what you do. And so I've come to look at, you know, where do you sense and feel God's presence? It might actually be when everything's falling apart. That's not what's wrong and needs to be fixed. That's where you see Jesus in different ways than you would otherwise. So that makes me think of that absence of God thing that people think about. Again, I don't say that lightly, like, well, here's the answer. Let's go off in the sunset holding hands. It's not like that. But maybe the suffering forces us to a place of greater knowledge of God. You know, I talked about my three kids yesterday, and one of them, the one in the middle, is the most spiritually attuned out of all of them, and she's the one who suffered the most, and she's the one who has a different perspective on God than the rest of us have, because there were times in her life where she had no one and nothing to hold on to. And I'm glad she made the decision to lean on God, and it's, I've seen the benefit in her life. And she's the best adjusted person in our family, far more than I am. So it's nice having a therapist living in the house with you. So, okay. And the last one is, this is, you know, we've talked about this already, but struggling is normal, right? And that's sort of like the crowning thing here, that the struggling is normal, even though some of the kinds of sources of struggling that we have are uniquely modern, and that's all that science stuff, right? Paul didn't have to deal with this, right? People in the medieval church didn't have to deal with most of this stuff, right? But we have these unique things with the explosion of scientific information, especially over the last 100 years, or last 5 years, right? We're constantly having to deal with things that our predecessors did not have to deal with, right? So that's a little bit different, but the other things, like the violence of God, that's a pre-Christian problem. That's a Jewish problem, right? The early Christians, people like Origen, who lived during the 200s around there, an allegorizer of Scripture, and he was one of many people who said, yeah, this can't be true. Right? So you allegorize these passages because they're struggling with them. The absence of God, as old as anything. What about other religions? Well, read the Old Testament, for heaven's sake. There's a constant temptation to follow the gods of the other nations. These are not new issues, right? What's new for us is maybe some of the scientific stuff, but for the most part, you know, this is, you know, the normality, let's say, of struggling with faith is something that's worth remembering that, you know, we're not alone. These are ancient issues. And here, not a sign, the struggling with faith is not a sign that we're sort of have left the path. In a way, it's actually a sign that we're on it because we're participating in something that's so common in the history of both Christianity and Judaism. So, okay, we have maybe a minute. Anybody want to add a question or a comment or anything, or maybe 2 minutes at the most? Yes. Yeah, that's in the sin of certainty. Yeah. Maybe not in exactly the same way that I'm doing now, but it's pretty close, so, yeah. Anybody else? Okay, yes, last one, go ahead.
How do you address the issue of the God of the gods?
Oh, you asked me that at 2:15 when we have to leave? I don't believe in a God in the gaps, but that's for another time I come to Pepperdine, so. All right, thank you, folks, I appreciate it. Thank you. See you.